Hi, and welcome to Hyperfixation, the podcast where we invite various interesting people to talk about their niche shared interests that they could just talk forever about. Here are your hosts. I'm Alex.
And I'm Nigel.
And today we have Yay Xavier. Phoebe, how are you?
Oh, hi, Ali. Hi, Nigel. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for being on.
Absolutely.
And what are you here to talk to today?
I am promoting my first book. I make comic books, and I've been putting comic books out for a couple of years, but just recently I published my first actual narrative prose book. I published my first narrative prose book, which is 17 short stories, and it's called Superliminal Latency.
Awesome.
Thank you. It's available right now. You can go to indieplanet.com/123go. And you'll find that amongst our comic books that we now have the book list.
Very cool.
Thanks.
Where did the title come from?
The title was something I came up with after I had sort of selected which stories were going to go into the collection. I've been writing these stories for about 20 years. Not every short story I've written goes into the collection, but... yeah, I have my usual writing process is that I generally come up with a title first and an ending first. And if I know the title and the ending, I generally find a way to get from one to the next, fill in the middle. But with this, since I already had like the collection of stories picked out, I just had to come up with something that I felt was like a cool branding for what it is. And what it is science fiction and horror.
Nice. So this has been a long time in the making then.
Absolutely. Yeah. The two oldest stories were written in 2003, I think. And the newest one, maybe 2018. And the newest one is a story called Targeted Adverts. And that one is actually, there's a podcast called Dust Horizons, where they make audio versions of science fiction stories. And it was a few years ago that was featured on that. It's still up there online. If you look up Dust Horizons Targeted Adverts, you can find a story by me that I love the fact that they did all sorts of sound effects and different voices for the different characters. But that is the last one. I've written maybe six or seven more since then that I'm starting to accumulate enough to make a second collection. But right now, I'm just here to promote the first one.
Mm. Nice. So how do you go about choosing which stories actually go into the collection and which don't?
I think there were two others that almost went into this collection, but then I started developing those ideas further, and they're part of another book altogether that I'm working on that will be one self-contained story. That happens to contain those two as chapters. Otherwise, it was mostly all of the complete stories that I had. I had a few more that if I wanted to buckle down and finish one or two of the half complete stories that I had at the time. There were maybe one or two that also almost went in because they were like 90% done. But I'm always working. I work a day job as well. I work in food service. So, my time is limited on what I can invest my creative energy into. I mostly put most of what I had complete into this collection.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you said that like the reason that you didn't include some like those two stories was because they were part of like something else and you were going to develop those ideas further. For the one that you're promoting, the collection that you're promoting now, could you maybe give an idea of what ideas that you were, or themes that you were kind of developing in this one? Because, like you mentioned that it's a science fiction thing, which is obviously a very broad and very interesting kind of umbrella, like making hand gestures that people can't see because this is a podcast. So could you kind of maybe go through that a bit?
Sure. Did you guys get a copy of it? Have you gotten to look it over at all?
I haven't yet. No. But
I'm happy to email you the PDF. So one of the things that I address first and foremost in the introduction is that part of this collection is my introduction of a genre I've been working on called horror porn. So the horror part of the book has these very graphic stories that are graphic with violence, sex, and substance abuse. And so that is one of the things that is recurring in the collection. I think there's about 6 of those stories. But I also kind of left a code in the titles of the stories so that if you don't want to read the sexual and like substance abuse material, it's easy to do that by just through the titles. And basically there's no uppercase lettering in the stories that are horror porn stories. My science fiction stories are mostly cyberpunk and mostly set in a particular shared universe that I have developed, which is the shared universe that my comic book Sidereal Apogee takes place in. And that is like in the 2450s to the 2460s, so like 400 years in the future. Where the whole solar system has been colonized, and there is an organization called SoulCorp, which is basically all the biggest corporations of the future get together, and they pick out who's going to control the government. So it's like this dystopian setting, but draped across the entire solar system. And the comic book I mentioned, Sidereal Apogee, is kind of like a rogues gallery kind of thing, where I sometimes call it bad guys versus even worse guys, and that the bad guys don't always win. And so some of those characters overlap in both the comic book and in these short stories. Some of them are unique to either. And so being as it is cyberpunk, it's usually a lot of having to do with hacking and AI sort of situations and other themes that are commonly found in cyberpunk.
Yeah. Like you mentioned, you said that this has been kind of a long process with writing. What does your kind of writing process look like? You know, it's like, you mentioned when you have the title and the ending, you have a good jump off place to go from there. Would you kind of have a certain time to write every day, or would you kind of stick with maybe one story before you move on to the next one, or would you work on a couple different things at a time?
Yeah, no, I'm ADD as fuck in that I have always have like 5 or 6 different projects going on at once. and that's actually how
I feel that.
Well, in our comic books, you know, it's an indie comic book team, and you kind of work at the pace that your artist can work at, or whomever you know, your other team members can work at. And since most of us have other jobs other than doing comic books or creative writing, that I could write a story over the course of a month, but it might take a year and a half to get it all drawn, because the artists that I work with aren't necessarily working exclusively with me, and they can only do 2 or 3 pages a month for my project. So things like that will dictate like how fast something can get done and which projects I happen to be working on. I generally do some work every night on whether it's just helping coordinate things with other people on my team, you know, spending an hour on Facebook discussing what we're doing and rescheduling, or, perfecting my budgets, paying people. Yeah, let's say it's an everyday thing. I find at least an hour or two to put some energy into it. But my writing itself, if I'm just sitting down to write, a lot of that will involve a lot of reading, a lot of research. I've been writing a story recently called Bluetooth. And for 2 or 3 days, maybe even 4 or 5 days, I spent researching shoegaze music, because I decided to use that as something that one of the characters was interested in the story. So as I'm writing, I'm also listening to albums in this genre of music that I'm not that familiar with, reading the histories of these bands, and so on and so forth. I have another one of the ones that did go in this collection that's in Superliminal Latency is called Own Worst Voodoo Doll. And that's another one that I did as much time researching as I did writing, And so it's like littered with all this like detailed information of what the Caribbean in North America was like in the 1820s, 1830s.
I can, yeah, it's like I was saying, thinking, I can definitely relate to even, it's like you said, you could write a story in a month and then it could take so much longer to get it like drawn and everything. I do feel that, like, you know, it's like, it's especially with, like, you know, you write something, even if, like, you know, like, it's like, you, for in your case, you want to have it, like, illustrated as well, and then, like, editing it, and, like, or, like, are you a big editor, or, like, because I find that I could write something in, like, you know, maybe a couple of weeks if I kind of set my home, but then, like, getting it to a point where I'm really happy with it, like, that's a different story.
Oh, I would say, as far as my own writing, I'm editing it constantly. Like, the next day, I go back and read what I wrote the day before, start rearranging where certain parts of it are. Okay, another part of my process is I'm often kind of drunk and often kind of stoned when I'm doing it. So, like, I'll have this, like, creative, like, imaginative flow going, but then maybe it's not as polished as it could be, and that's why I do need to write drunk, edit sober.
Seems fair.
Yeah. Oh, and
there's there's some director that did that. I can't remember I heard about it recently.
That quote is often misattributed to Bukowski, the Los Angelian writer. But yeah, that's a famous quote that I don't think is attributed to anyone. I think attributed to
just a bit of wisdom.
It wasn't a director. It was Ken Kesey, I think, used to do that. The One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest guy.
Right. Okay. Ken Kesey also did a lot of LSD, so he might have been writing while tripping.
Explains an awful lot.
You just got to get all the, like, you got to get all your ideas out on paper, and then you got to go back and look at them and kind of think, all right.
Look, yes. I will... To divert into personal anecdote territory, when I took acid in Amsterdam, we took the strain which is meant to be like the most hallucinogenic. And so everyone else was like, we were starting to trip, and all that happened for me was things got slightly fuzzy, or if there was like a zigzag or spiral pattern on something, it would sort of move. And then I got really, like, I got the zoomies for a while. I couldn't stand still. Then I was, like, fixated on this portrait in the guest bedroom of the place we were staying, the villa we were in. And then I ended up writing a 12-page conspiracy theory-looking document, which was, like, a pitch for a TV show / comic book, which included, like, real-time illustrations of, like, what the characters in it would be doing, how it would work, dialogue, which I was then cribbing from my friends in real time. They would say stuff, and I would be in the headspace of this character, and then I would write it down, because I'd be like, that's what the characters would say to this character. So, like, there is some sort of merit to, like, having a bunch of... Because then, like, when I came down off of it, then I was like... Then they were like, so what the hell did you just write? Because I was literally, like, I found an A4 refill pad or, like, one of those printer things, you know, of paper. And I was just scribbling. Oh, I had no, like, fine motor control. So the pen was clutched in my fingers. And I was just like, yeah. And then I had to, like, go and edit that then when I was, like, not on drugs.
Bring any of those ideas, like, to fruition in other writing projects?
Yeah. Like, I have that a lot, where I'd be like,
there you go.
This is an idea then that I had 12 years ago for something, and I can use it in a project now. But, like, that, like, at its core, the idea I had there is, like, a really solid idea that, like, I somehow managed to, like, chart all the, like, bounds of this is what it's going to be at its most extreme, and I understand what the core dynamics of all the characters at its most implicit are, and I was like, go me for being on psychedelics.
Absolutely. This one time, I was staying with friends in Portland, Oregon, and they decided to get an 8-ball of ketamine, and that is a ridiculous amount of ketamine. No one needs that much ketamine. And I was like, what? No. And I think I might have done a little bit on the first night, but they basically just tripped on ketamine for 4 or 5 days straight, And I just started writing down the ridiculous conversations, and that became material for a TV show pitch we were working.
Well, there you go. Look.
But it required me to be the sober one to write down what they were doing.
It requires you not to take an obscene amount of ketamine.
Exactly.
Inspiration comes from anywhere. It's like, don't try this at home, but you never know.
Yeah.
No, I'm willing to endorse taking drugs if you do it like in a safe way and then like, in a space where if something goes wrong, you can get help and you won't be put in prison. Which isn't like a lot of spaces, but I'm very pro drug use.
And I've gotten to the point in my life where all the drugs that I do are just booze and pot. Like I've had my party days. I'm 45 years old, almost 46, and my body just can't take it anymore.
That is very fair. Fair points being made on all accounts, but just like a little bit as a treat. Inspiration comes from anywhere.
Yeah.
You said you're kind of a bit of an editing as you go kind of person.
Absolutely. And also though, I have an editor who I worked with on this book. The book wouldn't be as good as it is without my editor, Joseph Cervellin, who's been working with me almost 2 years and I'm polishing it. And he edits some of my comic books as well. And I am the editor in chief over all of our brand 123Go. So I do a lot of editing when I have other people's stories going into some of our anthology books.
How long, or how strenuous a process do you put stuff through for editing? Because I know like individual people who like create stuff have their own opinions on editing. Like there's a lot of people who are, especially like newer kind of authors as well, they're really recalcitrant to get edits, you know, like why are you changing my words? But like how strenuous do you put other people's stories through, and how like open are you to having your stuff be edited, especially like for your first prose collection of stuff?
I think that I am a little more hands-on with editing than some of the people that I've worked with are used to in independent comic books. They've just straight up said that, like they didn't expect me to want to make all these changes to their story. And it was kind of like, well, this is editing. This is what editing is. And like, I didn't want to put the story into the book unless they were willing to make those changes, because otherwise it would have been a story I'm not interested in publishing. So I've referenced before how I looked at it. I look at editing kind of like sculpting. That like, okay, there's a pretty raw block there of, it's got, the shape is coming into, I'm starting to see the shape, but there's more that needs to be shaved down and shaped for it to be the beautiful piece of art that I imagine it can be. As far as me, my words getting edited, a lot of times whenever my editor gave me the question of like, hey, maybe we should change this, I was like, no. But anything he was like, yeah, we got to change this, I was like, okay, I defer to you. Like, you have a degree in this. You are a professional writer. Like, yeah, I hired him for a reason, because he's able to do this. My ego comes into play sometimes. Sometimes I really think I wrote a really witty turn of phrase. And I was just reading one the other day in the book, in Super Limo Latency, where me and my friend Joe, who I did used to do hallucinogenics with, sometimes we'd look at each other and be like, yo, do you even drugs, bro? Like, do you even lift? But like, do you even drugs, bro? And my editor changed it to, do you even do drugs? And I was like, no, that's not it. Like, that's not what we used to say. He's like, yeah, but I think readers that don't have that history of like, exchanging that phrase with their friend all the time, they might not get that you're doing the do you lift, do you even lift, bro. So I don't know. There are parts of it that I look back at now and I'm like, this is not what I wrote. This is not originally what I wrote. But I know it got better in so many other places that I kind of am deferring to him, trusting his judgment and hoping that our readers love it.
So there's a kind of compromise at work.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, It's like, I remember, it's interesting you mentioned about sculpting, because I remember I was in, because I'm doing creative writing at the moment, and last semester, one of my teachers said that, like, a lot of time writing and, like, editing and stuff, it's not what you add in, it's what you take away, like, comparing it to sculpting in that manner, yeah. And I've always, like, that's some really good writing advice I've gotten.
Yeah, no, and that is actually, there's a little bit of rearranging of where some of the paragraphs would go that Joseph would do, but mostly what he was doing was removing words. And and very, very few times, like maybe 4 or 5 times throughout, he was like, I think we should add something here because that, like, this part hasn't been fully enforced enough. You need to, like, repeat this or add a detail about this here and there, and just to improve the flow. And I mean, to me, they're stories that I've read 15, 20 times on, and I love them. I'm like, I can't believe I wrote this. This is great, and I want to share it with my friends. And my friends mostly give me back feedback that's just like, wow, that's amazing that you can write like this. And so, but then I give it to a professional writer. They're like, yeah, but it could be better.
Mm.
Yeah. So for him, he wants to make, he also doesn't want his name on it, you know, unless it's something that he feels is at a professional level that we have a chance to sell it, sell thousands of copies or whatever.
I getcha. Yeah, it's like a team effort, kind of.
Absolutely. At the point that you start working with your editor, you're on a team and you're no longer like the sole proprietor of the project.
For sure. It's like, I remember like when, again, in with the same lecture, she had this thing where we had to describe a scene like, in kind of just a few sentences, we weren't given very long to write it. And we were told to kind of be, I think it was as sparse as like as we figured we could with our writing. And then we'd read it out, and our lecturer would still be able to find a word. She'd be like, do you need like, that word? Like, usually an adjective or something? Like, and you're just like, you're looking at it and you're like, oh shit, I kind of didn't, like. Oh,
yeah.
I think maybe Nigel's internet could have dropped. Oh, you're back.
Heck.
Are you good? Can you hear us and everything?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay.
But yeah, no, yeah. Removing words is a huge part of editing. One of the stories that we have going into my it's a anthology book, a Halloween horror anthology that we do called 13th Moon. And going into our second volume of that, I had a story, which is really good. I really like it, called Lace Wing. And it's kind of about like these kids that are camping in the woods that are college age students. And that there's these giant bugs, giant lace wings that are like eating them and whatnot. And but like a whole half of the story happened in this one character's head and like was just way too much drama about their relationship. And like the worthiness of that, and like it's like this is maybe like them expressing something, that writer expressing something that they needed to get out at that moment, which is totally cool. I honor that. But like as far as the flow of the story, like that's not scary, and it's not contributing like enough to like the character is already fleshed out enough that we don't need to hear all these internal concerns of theirs. So I definitely probably cut like 30% of what they had on the paper, words that they had on the paper when they first gave me the story. But I also know I wanted to keep the story because I love the art and the ending was strong enough that I was like, yeah, oh, I would want to read this. I would want to, in a book that I'm going to buy, I want stories that are as good as But for me to get there, I had to cut like 30% of what they'd written.
Sure. You know, it is always a struggle though, just deciding like, you know, kind of like what to cut, what to keep, because it's like, even if you know that like it's better to take out like unnecessary things. Like there's a part in your brain that's like, oh, but I really like that paragraph.
Yes, exactly. No, and that it, yeah, sometimes. And then, well, you could kind of just cut things like that and put them in like a scrapbook or a scrap document that maybe you find use for it later.
Oh yeah, I usually keep drafts. Like personally, generally speaking, keep drafts anyway, so you know I could have them there if I need to go back and like I'm kind of thinking, okay, maybe I shouldn't have cut that thing, or maybe I can have that thing but work it in somewhere different,
or yeah, in another absolutely. Story
just to have it.
I keep also documents that'll just be like five different like single sentences to describe a story that I'd like to write or I have a good idea for, but it's only like a sentence or two long.
Yeah, that's a good idea. A little kind of blurb.
We don't have an infinite amount of ideas, like an infinite amount of story ideas. So if I get five extra, I'm writing them down.
That is very true. good idea.
How often do you return to those ideas then?
Often when, okay, so if it's a new comic, okay, new comic book or a new pitch that I see, somebody posted that they need a science fiction story or a horror story or a horror sci-fi story, open up a few of those documents and check which ideas I had, or check it against, do any of my existing stories, or would they apply for this pitch? But so yeah, I would say like semi-regularly, I'm kind of writing two stories at once right now. I told you the Bluetooth one is one that I'm working on, but I'm also working on one called Withering Rose. And that one started as like a sentence one night and then like paragraph the next night. And I think it's up to a page and a half that I wrote the rest of it. Then a week later, and I'm just sitting on that. And I'll probably go back to it after I finish the Bluetooth one, which I'm really excited about.
Nice.
Are these then being written for any specific publications or just writing them? Like have these come as a response to seeing a prompt or a call for submissions for a particular thing? Or is it just
not these two just writing them? Yeah, not these two stories. These two stories specifically are coming from my interest this year in magic realism. I have a story in Superliminal Latency called The Slipstream Fiasco, which is a slipstream cyberpunk story, and it's meant to be a surreal sort of story. And that, like, I even mentioned that, I think, in the introduction. And that talking to my editor, though, he was like, yeah, but I actually think this one's a little, this, your two surreal stories are this one and this one, not the one that you intentionally wrote as a surreal story. I was like, okay, back to the drawing board. Let me go back and read some magic realism and pick up some nuances that I hadn't really picked up from before. And mm-hmm. So first I was reading Borges, Ficciones. And while reading Borges is where I got the idea for this story. And this is like that story is going to be kind of like my answer to reading that book. And the Withering Rose story is kind of a surreal horror story as well. What did I move on to next? And then I also read John Courtney Grimwood, End of the World Blues, which is definitely a surreal sci-fi fantasy kind of book. And Neil Gaiman, The Ocean at the End of the Pond, or at the End of the Lane, I just finished last week. So I'm immersing myself in it.
Is it good?
Oh my God, it's good. It took me 3 days to finish it. It's not that long, though. It's only 225 pages, I think.
To read it because they're bringing the stage version to Dublin. And I want to go and see it, but then I'm like, I've had this book for 5 years and I've never read it. I probably should read it before I pay like 40 quid to go see a production of it and not understand it.
is that where you guys are located?
Yeah.
Awesome. I thought you guys had Irish accents, but I wasn't going to presume.
that's us.
Okay, cool. No, actually, this is all just method acting I'm doing for my acting group. Me, Brad, Chad, Theo, Steven, Chad. At Ross.
I just meant different than a regular combine, British accent.
Yeah, we're trying to combine long form and short form comedy into this comedy we call medium comedy.
Medium comedy.
Medium comedy.
It's now a seance.
Yeah. That'd be an interesting take on just now when you're saying about seances and like medium comedy, some sort of like, I don't really know like any sort of like comp to draw from for the like spiritual side of it. But you know, those like, oh, we're going to like get in touch with the devil, kind of like Ouija, the film, but not like that kind of thing, but make it a comedy. I think that would do really well, because like there are horror comedies, but to my knowledge, there's not one that's like explicitly about like mediums and seances.
Take it and run with it. But
say again?
As far as I said, take it and run with it. But as far as the ocean at the end of the lane, yes, you should read it. It from what I read afterwards, there's like it's his most autobiographical book, and that. Yeah, it contains the most of like his actual experience in it, and I read American Gods. I read his first short story collection, The Anansi Boys. I read a bunch of Gaiman. Oh, I read the entire Sandman series. But yeah, that book was probably right now is my favorite of his writing.
Definitely should read it, because I only read one Neil Gaiman book ever. It was about. Yes, it was Coraline, and that was about like 14 years ago. I read the book.
Yes, excellent.
I read the book, and then I saw the movie, and the movie terrified me.
Yeah, no, I've only seen the movie of that one, and yes, that is terrifying.
Yeah, I was like, oh, I read the book, like, it won't be that scary, and then I was like, this is terrifying. I've never gone back to it. I should. But no,
That's like not a kid's thing, but it's like animated, so you think it's for kids, but it's not. It's really
not. Like,
if you're looking for something similar, I would recommend the Graveyard book, because it's another one that he wrote for a younger audience. That's like, I don't know, it's sort of uniquely terrifying, because it's about this like sort of ghost boy, ghost-ish boy. He's not really like fully a ghost, but he lives in a graveyard full of ghosts, and his name is Bod, because it's short for nobody. And he's being hunted by this guy called the Man Jack, which I think, like, I really love how Neil Gaiman draws on like folklore and kind of concepts, and this is great for like inspiration. Like I love the way he takes inspiration from stuff and sort of like needle focuses it in, because this like the Man Jack, he's part of this group of Jacks, which are like all the Jacks from like fairy stories, and you know, like Jack Be Nimble, Jack the Giant Killer, Jack Frost. That's all that, like, he's the Man Jack.
Oh, that's class.
Yeah,
I'll definitely have to read that.
Yeah, he created a pretty interesting standalone paranormal sort of backdrop for the ocean at the end of the lane. He's you know, a master of mythology and the retelling of mythology. I found some interesting paranormal ideas in there that I never heard in any other material.
Okay.
Yes. 4 stars, 5 stars.
6 stars, fuck it.
No?
going above and beyond.
Yeah. Do you have, like, any main sources of inspiration, or is it just, like, a case of, like, anything and everything could spark kind of a creative prompt? Or are there things that you return to a lot?
I watch a lot of TV, probably more than I should, TV and movies. So good sci-fi movies and good sci-fi television is a huge source of inspiration. This year, I'm so happy with last night, because this year, one of my biggest inspirations has been Everything Everywhere All at Once on Twitter. Actually, it says pronouns Jobu/Tupaki. So I'm so happy to see that movie win. That has been a very big inspiration for me of late. The Expanse series on TV. I don't know if you guys have seen that sci-fi thing that ran for 6 years. It's based on 9 books. So since they canceled it after 6 books, I bought the 7th book. I don't think I'm going to go back and read the first 6. I have most of the story understood. And being like 100 pages into the 7th book right now, I didn't miss a beat. Like they didn't change it that much that it's hard to go back and forth between the two mediums. But yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely. I draw my inspiration from other creators, other creative medium, but also in my life, you know, people and experiences, and reading. I haven't been, I'd say in the last 10 years, acted reading so much, and that recently I've become re-interested in reading, and part of that is a little bit of a varied range of writers, because like having all these little different spices from different creators, I'm not really like copying any of them directly. I'm just being inspired by the pool of their genius.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because like you say, there's only a finite, there's a finite amount of story ideas. But this is something that we sort of touched on in the episode we did on amulets. The fact that like these sort of things, I mean, we were talking about it with like kind of traditions and practices, but the same as like with storytelling and stuff, you know, that like we keep building on the stories of the past. We're telling the same stories. Like when you look at, like, I know the Trojan War is a lot, like there's a lot of retellings of that in different mediums, but even like, you know, like obviously the Bible is a big one as well. People like C.S. Lewis take inspiration from that to write Narnia, and then people are inspired by Narnia to write things like Oliver K. Langmead's Birds of Paradise. You know, like it's this never-ending chain where we're always like paying respect to and building on top of those that came before us. There's never a bad story that you can't take inspiration. Like even Lovecraft. Like Lovecraft wrote great cosmic horror, now deplorable politics, but like that was answered in a really interesting way in Lovecraft County by Matt Ruff. The show, not so much. The show was trying to do like a lot of stuff all at once, and it kind of felt very muddled. But like, it was really interesting to have this book about people of color dealing with the legacy of Lovecraft in a cosmic horror setting. I was like, I was all there for it.
Yeah, no, Lovecraft is problematic as far as off the page. And that's all his xenophobia. He turned it into these creatures, but it was really the people he was living around.
Yeah, like the horror at Red Hook or whatever the name of that story is. Like, Red Hook is just the neighborhood he lived in Boston or whatever, which was the first neighborhood to get rid of segregation laws. So, you know, people of color could live in the same area as white people. And he was like, not having that. I'm actually terrified of this.
He was like, I'm scared for some reason.
Yes, but like, yes. It's unknowable for some unknowable reason.
Yeah, but like even at that time, he like his beliefs were like way pat, like beyond the pale. Like I know racism, you know, has always been a thing, and it's still a thing now, and segregation was still in place. But like even then, loads of people were viewing that as like extreme. Like his wife, when you read like her letters and diaries and stuff, describe him as going into like paroxysms of like these fits where he was just that like that incensed by xenophobia and racism. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen
so
people
large.
Blow up over stuff like that. I think in America that's not even that uncommon, sadly.
Yeah, sadly.
People go on explosive diatribes of why they dislike people that are not like them. And there's probably that sort of expression is probably going on at a bar in every town in America every night, sadly.
Oh, probably, yeah. Like, you see those videos of people that, you know, they've just decided to stop in the street, or in the case of a video I saw earlier on today, some lady was just in a diner and started yelling at this lesbian couple. You know, just this diatribe of hatred. It just, like, I don't know, randomly, in the middle of her day, she was that incensed that she had to start yelling at them. But also, yeah, like, that kind of, being on the receiving end of that, like, does also spark creativity and ideas. You know, like Babel by Orif Kwong is based off of the racism that she was subjected to while she was in college. And then also Yellowface, her upcoming book, is about that kind of thing, but in the publishing industry, from what I'm aware. So like you can draw inspiration from anything, which is like, I don't know, that's nice to see that the human spirit is indomitable.
Definitely. It's like, even with like horrible things, like, you know, so many people have been able to make amazing art out of it. Like,
yeah. Pain is definitely a inspiration. Pain and fear can be used, can be turned into something creative.
Yeah.
I think it's that how you flip it, what angle you approach it from, and can you read, if every story has been told, like, what can we use to make this one interesting this time around? If we're going to redo this trope, if we're going to bring this theme back, how do we flip it, make it, throw a curveball in it, make it a little more interesting this time?
Yeah, because, like, even in the case of classics, you can update them with, like, modern sensibilities and stuff. Like, how would the world of something that was written 400 years ago, let's say, translate to the modern world? I don't know. It's one of the main things that I was really annoyed with the BBC Dracula adaptation, which I won't get into, because that I will yell for 10 minutes at least about how annoyed I am at that. That'd be good. That'd be good. Hyperfix Hitchens episode. But you know, like, as the world progresses, we're always going to find these new ways to tell stories. But as a sci-fi writer, how much are you drawing on, like, sort of what I'm going to nicely term real world dystopia for stuff, or is it sort of like more out there kind of like imagined worlds with imagined problems? You know, like, are you going the, like, Philip K. Dick route? Or is it more so, I don't know. I don't even know who's, like, a modern, because I feel like a lot of modern sci-fi now is like, oh God, we're in a hellhole. Whereas sci-fi from the 60s is like, wouldn't it be great if we lived in a perfect place?
So when I write, like, this future cyberpunk world where, the corporations get to pick the government, like, that's not a complete exaggeration from my worldview, or at least my worldviews when I started to develop that continuity. Mm-hmm. And I think that I, as many sci-fi writers do kind of take the world about us and then kind of just apply future fast forward imagination and creativity of where this could go. And you do talk about the modern world to a degree, but, like, you know, dress it up differently, dress it up in sci-fi lasers and lightsabers or whatever. I love P.K. Dick, P.K.D. I do not, however, believe that I'm living two lifetimes simultaneously like he did towards the end of his life.
Weird point of his life.
Yes.
Just one of those things.
Yeah. I'm not afraid to get weird or talk about the graphic stuff, like, which I don't think is maybe a mainstream sci-fi these days or mainstream horror, is to kind of go as, like, I don't do it just for cringe or just for gore. Like, those elements, when they're in my horror porn stories, are there to round the whole picture out, to complete the horror of it, I guess.
Yeah, just, it's like you said, like, you know, like, including that, like, shit, like, even if it's not the most, like, what's the word, stream, like, stories like that are still, like, are still so important, like, you know, like, to go, like, deep into the horror in that way.
What's the weirdest you've gone for a
story? Stories?
Or the weirdest thing you've drawn from?
I don't know. Slipstream Fiasco, I mentioned that one. That's kind of my favorite one in Superliminal Latency. And I did a cocktail of various drugs over the course of a few months that kind of pushed that story in a number of different directions. That would be my most, like, drugged out story as far as when I was being regularly tripping on something to, like, come up with these crazy ideas. That's also one of the only stories that I use. I forget the exact name of this practice, but it's when you just, like, clip a line or a half of a sentence out of various different, like, medias, like articles on the internet, whether it's news or a review of an album, this or that, and just cutting till you have, like, a jumble of 30 different phrases that weren't connected to begin with, were written by other people, but you just sort of arrange them into a new poetry. And I applied that at least two or three times in the Slipstream Fiasco. I used that technique. So yeah, so that's kind definitely of like, one of
kind of like how like John Lennon and Kurt Cobain used to write songs, and David Bowie as well. They used to like get all the lyrics, and then they would sort of chop them up and then rearrange them. Like the lyrics to songs would be in a different order to what they've written in. But what you're doing then is sort of a pastiche then of other things.
Yeah, yeah, like a collage. And Robert Anton Wilson, who is another author that I've gotten into in the last couple of years, he used that technique regularly. And but I had already done it by the time I started reading about him doing it. I was like, oh, cool. I have a similar writing style as Robert Anton Wilson.
How about?
Yeah.
I've never heard of Robert Anton Wilson. What has he written?
Okay, the Illuminati trilogy is kind of his most famous work, and that was co-written.
Oh.
But
I do know that.
Also he's the founder of the Discordian Society, which are these people in the 60s and 70s. Who are just like anti-religion, but made a cult out of it. And he's a very fascinating figure from the 20th century. He eventually died from like late age from, he had polio as a child. And even though it was cured as a child, the like lasting damage to his organs from it as an adult later claimed him a little early. But yeah, no, he's a brilliant writer and a smartest. Oh, he wrote for Playboy for years. He was a columnist in Playboy, I think, is how he got famous. How he was already kind of, had a career as a writer before his first novel started charting.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he's a fascinating writer.
Yeah. So
I highly recommend him as well.
Sorry?
I said I highly recommend him as well.
Mm.
Nice.
Do Playboy still do the things like, I know the whole joke of like, oh, I'm reading it for the articles, but like, that's where a lot of writers would get their start. And so like Stephen King is probably a big example. Like a lot of his short stories that ended up in the first two, maybe three of his short story collections, like Skeleton Crew and Night Shift, were all sold to gentleman magazines like Hustler and Playboy and stuff. Like, is that a thing that they still do?
Oh my god, I should start pitching them.
Yeah, like, because I see now with authors, you know, where you'll read their biography and it's like their writing has appeared in The New Yorker and McSweeney's and stuff, but nowadays you don't see a lot of that where it's like, oh, this story first appeared in Hustler or whatever. And so, like, I don't know whether you know this, like, is that a thing still that they do where they publish like literary fiction?
I don't know. I've not seen any of those magazines in years. I have Pornhub, but
they should start doing that on the website where it's like, yeah, here's like porn videos. But then also we have this section where you can read genre fiction.
Yeah. Hey, if the websites will have me, I'm happy to have my work posted there.
whatever suit.
Yeah, and I'm happy to have my writing posted anywhere. Yeah, basically.
As long as you're credited for it.
Yeah, please. I'm gonna have to look into that now. But one of the things that I do know about this Bluetooth story that I'm working on, I feel really good about it, and I feel like it could possibly be the best story I've ever written. And So as long as I'm still feeling that good about it when it's done, I'm thinking of trying to hire a person as a agent, but as someone I pay just to get this one story published somewhere. And which I don't think is the way literary agents usually work, but I think I've been on this website Readzy lately, which is where I found the woman who reformatted my book for its Kindle edit. And there's a lot of weird writing and editing services offered up there, where I kind of feel I might be able to find someone to be like a gun for hire agent for a single story.
Readzy, is it?
No, R-E-E-D-S-Y.
R-E-E-D-S-Y.
Yeah, And I'd never known about that until I saw my Kindle version of my book and how bad they had butchered the spacing when I uploaded my document into their KDF file or whatever. And I was like, okay, we need help here. And so that I found Weezy.
Yeah, this also feels like it feels like it could like be an invaluable tool for writers, though.
Readzy. If you're a writer, please go look on Readzy and see if anything there is useful to you. There's also an option which I think I'm going to use soon, where you can pay $50 and then they will read your story or your book or whatever. Then for paying $50, like 10 people will read your book, and they're professional editors, writers, etc. So you're going to get feedback quickly, whether it's good or not. You know, that depends on how good your art is, I guess. But hopefully the critical response, like any criticism, can then shape your development in the future.
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to do that.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. But like, I say also that was like a real wake up call when you saw how badly the Kindle was formatted.
Oh yeah, I had no idea.
Getting something off of Kindle?
I don't use Kindle. Like, I don't buy things off of Kindle, so I didn't really know. I just know that on in the writers community on Twitter, which I follow tons of people on Twitter that are writers, and all of us being independent people trying to like push our book and whatnot, that so many of them do sell on Kindle. So I was like, all right, let me do that, because that seems to be what all authors are doing. And Joseph and I had worked very hard over 2 years to get this 280-page perfect PDF, which is what you purchase on indieplanet.com. When you go there, you're getting that PDF that me and Joseph wrote, worked on, or you can order the physical copy, and that'll be a 288-page, kind of the size of a comic book, but it's a book. And that document, though, the one I went to plug it into Kindle's stuff, no, it's going to totally change so much of your spacing, editing. And it also does this thing where it like capitalizes the first letter of each chapter, which in some places made the whole page look sloppy then. I had to hire a woman named Rebecca. She was excellent to work with. And I had to hire someone who understood Kindle formatting to get the book into a shape that right now I'm happy to sell it on Kindle. But I had it posted up there for about a month that I was like, don't even buy that, because like the spacing is
all.
It's free. It's free to get posted up on Kindle. You need an Amazon account, and you need to like verify a bank account that they can export the money into, any money that you're that you make through them. So I'm live on Kindle right now, and I do, as long as you understand that how Kindle is going to change like your final work, I recommend using it. But it's trial and error. You know, it's my first book. This is me learning that in while I go. And I know that next time I'll get that editing done before I try to post the Kindle.
Yeah, it's all about learning.
Mm-hmm.
So as kind of before we wrap it up, is there anything in particular, like it's like, maybe what's next? Like, I know you mentioned that you have a second collection that's more of a self-contained story, or plans.
I'm pushing this book right now. I want to get to like 500 copies sold, and until I get there, every single a podcast appearance or anything, interviews that I do, I'll definitely be pushing this book super limited latency. But other things on the horizon right now, I have a book, a comic book called Viking Saga of the North. And we have a really good Instagram going for that one. It's with all underscores in between the words, but Viking Saga of the North on Instagram. That will be a Kickstarter sometime in the next, probably by early summer, maybe this year. And I've been working on that with my friend Jose Diaz out of Guatemala. And that's just about done. I think I have two more pages to letter in the English version. Then we're going to do a German version. I'm going to get the translation for that in the next week or two. It will be the first time I've ever lettered in German, so that's going to be a learning process as well. But what else do we have coming up? Oh, 13th Moon Volume 2 will be released sometime, probably by the summer as well. Gunmetal Black Ops number 4 should drop sometime this year, possibly this summer. You can find me on Spoutable, if anybody out there is on Spoutable yet, at Phoebe A. Xavier 123Go. We also have Facebook, just like a 123Go publications fan page or whatever. I'm on Instagram at Phoebe123Go. Yeah, at Phoebe123Go on Instagram. I don't really post much on Instagram though. But yeah, that exists. And yeah, I'm on Twitter, but I argue too much on Twitter about politics, so I don't give that out too much. I'm on my fourth Twitter in 12 years because I argue so much about politics. Actually, I had to buy a new phone because Twitter knew when I tried to make my last account, they're like, "Nope, we know who you are. You use this phone too much." So I bought a whole new phone to get back on Twitter. All right,
Twitter
what
said
else?
No.
Yeah, no, Twitter was like, "Nope, nope, nope." But yeah, so I would say that those are the things to look forward to from 123Go Publications and from me. Yeah, that's all I'm plugging right now.
Oh, cool. So, yeah. Normally I'd ask, is there anything you want to plug? But like, I think you've done all that. So,
that was it. Yeah.
Thanks for the seamless transition. Nigel, where can we find you?
You can mainly find me on Twitter at SpicyNigel, where recently I've been tweeting about what show I've never seen I should watch. I did a poll. Apparently, Avatar The Last Airbender. Everyone thinks I should watch that show. So that'd be it. I was really excited that Elvis won nothing at the Oscars. Hell yes. And then some acting I was really proud of in the new episode of Folklore. And then also just like a mock-up design for like, I don't even know what it is, but I had this idea buzzing around in my head. So I made like an image for it. It's called Funerary. And the tagline is, "You can't keep a dead god down." Don't know what I'm going to do with it, but like, it's a nice skull looking logo. Yeah.
Nice.
That's it mainly.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at AliCat_. Ali spelt like alleyway, cat spelt with a K. And you can find me on Instagram at Ali_K_Keegan. You can find the podcast at HyperFixationsP on Twitter.
Or at HyperFixationsPod on Instagram. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, be that Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or jumbled up in whatever the hell James Joyce is saying in Finnegan's Wake, wherever. If you would like to come onto the show to discuss one of your hyperfixations, please feel free to reach out at any of the aforementioned social media. If you like the show, tell a friend. If you didn't, nobody likes a fucking narc.
And that is all for this week. Phoebe, you are an absolute delight to have on. Thank you. Thank you again for being on. Goodbye, everyone.
Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
Signing off.